Wake-Up Call on WNRN. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The Wake-Up Call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Yeehaw! Welcome, everybody. How are you today? I'm having a good time here because you know why? Do you know why I'm having a good time today? Because Courtney Stewart's here today.
Hello, Rick.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being our guest today. It's nice to have The Hook as an underwriter, and it's even better when people from The Hook come in to show their love and appreciation for what we do at WNRN.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you very much. Courtney Stewart is a senior editor. Are you the only senior editor?
I guess I'm the only one with that title, but I think we are all essentially writers, staff
writers. Are there junior editors?
There are no junior
editors.
Sophomore
editors?
I think the titles sort of don't actually describe what we all basically do, which is write stories.
All right. Courtney Stewart is from The Hook, a senior editor by title, a journalist by blood.
Perhaps.
Anyway, we'll hear with Courtney today, Courtney Stewart from The Hook, a weekly publication here in Charlottesville. If you're living in Richmond, maybe near the 103.1 and listening, or for some reason, if you're in Harrisonburg on 95.1 and you don't drive every Thursday over to Charlottesville to pick up the fresh copy of The Hook, maybe with our hour today and some of the public current events, you will start to make that part of your weekly habit. Courtney, we got a couple stories to go through with the hour. Things, stories that you've written, sort of like current issues of recent current events. We're going to be talking about Justin Abshire, which was an article that you wrote.
Yeah, Justine Abshire and her husband. She's Justine, of course, has died in November of 2006 in mysterious circumstances, and her widower, Eric Abshire, currently sits in the Central Virginia Regional Jail awaiting his October trial on first-degree murder charges.
So we're going to get with that in a short while. Get a little, for those of you who aren't fully aware, a little bit of the basic story, and then what comes up, a regular article with news that Courtney has been writing. You know, one of the first things that I want to get to, though, as a journalist, as someone who writes on a regular basis for The Hook, is the news that's been going around about the Sherlock Holmes book, Study in Scarlet, that Albemarle County is under consideration for removing from the sixth grade reading list.
Yeah, I think that's it's a very interesting hot topic. The idea, you know, is it censorship? Should they do this based on the one complaint that I understand, a parent complained that it had, I guess, sections that are offensive to Mormons. And should that be the basis for taking a book off a reading list? Is it age appropriate for the sixth grade, which is the classes that it was being used in?
You haven't written a story on this. It hasn't been in The Hook.
No, but you know, it's something we may well end up covering.
But as the journalist, as the writer, I want to get your immediate thought process, and as a parent as well. I believe you said that you have a child who's recently
I have a child finished. Who actually just finished sixth grade, so that was not one of the books in the city schools where that was used. I think it's really dangerous, obviously, to think about censoring things. I think there can be a tendency to be too politically correct, but I also think that there are certain materials that aren't appropriate for certain ages, and so, of course, whenever you make a reading list, the books that you don't include on it, you are, in fact, not censoring, but you're saying that this book is not appropriate for this child or this age group at this time. And obviously that happens in every school, every day. So this one book, I don't know. I actually haven't read that book, or if I did, it was a long time ago. So I don't know the actual sections.
But do you find yourself being a journalist or a parent first when the topic comes up? As many people have said, and again, we are talking with Courtney Stewart from The Hook. The Hook has not done a story on this. Courtney has not written a story on this. We will be getting to some of the stories that she has covered in sort of the updated fashion very shortly. But I thought, we have a journalist who's a parent in here. The book, from my understanding of what I've read in another newspaper, is not being taken out of the school system, not being censored from the permanent library, just taken off the list of potentially usable teaching materials. Where do you jump in first?
Well, I would come down, you know, as a parent and a journalist, I would come down on the side of being open and letting kids read whatever material they are capable of absorbing, but providing the context that the book was written in, teaching that. I mean, that's not to say that I would want white supremacist tomes to be what they're being taught in school or something like that. But if they happen to see one, I would want them to understand the context that it was written. I would want them to understand the controversy or the hate that it's spewing, and so that they can realize that does exist in the world and maybe be better equipped to deal with things. So I don't know. I don't know what the school board's going to have to decide. And I think there is dissent, like people disagree on that issue.
I believe that's what I read in the last article that I saw, was that it had gone from the letter to a committee who had decided to pass it on to the superintendent, who had decided to pass it on to the school board, and then the school board had said, sort of in an, I don't know that they, I wasn't at the meeting, so I can't say whether they argued, but certainly they had dissenting opinions, and so that decision has been delayed until a later time.
Well, I mean, there was recently, a UVA professor just put out a new edition of Huckleberry Finn, and there was a big controversy about, it has been in the various editions that have been put out, whether certain words should be removed or whether they should be left in. This recent edition leaves everything in because, of course, the book was written at a certain time and the words that the author chose reflect the attitudes of the time, and so you're getting the context. And I think it's important. I wouldn't object to my kids reading, you know, most of these books as long as they're learning it in a full way and the context is being discussed.
And my understanding is that when the school board went through that, again, we are talking with Courtney Stewart from The Hook about a topic, the Sherlock Holmes book that's been in the news recently, about a news that she has not written about, and I'm going to get into a few of her articles in just another moment, was the book, should it be used for teaching sixth graders about that sort of material? Could a sixth grader understand, what's the phrase that I wrote down, deductive reasoning, which is what the Sherlock Holmes story is about, or discrimination? Was a sixth grader capable of understanding discrimination in the proper way? And the teacher of a sixth grader capable of doing that?
There are also all different levels within each grade. I mean, there are kids who are maybe able to handle a book that's more complex and maybe carries some weighty subjects. And then there are some kids for whom that's just going to be too early. And I think, I don't know the details of what class this was being taught. So without having all the information, I don't know what I think should happen, but I'll be interested to see what they do.
All right, well, let's move on to Courtney's actual articles. Thank you for
jumping in. Let me talk about something I know about,
right,
Rick.
Well, I appreciate that, because a lot of the news, the most recent articles have come out this week, and I wanted to take advantage of having a parent, a journalist,
yeah,
et cetera, on the air to talk about that for a second. Let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for allowing us to be on the air today with Courtney. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports encourages you to be kind and have fun and do the right thing. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville. They have three locations in Richmond. For more information online, it's brms.com. All right, back with our guest today, Courtney Stewart. Courtney, we chatted about potential topics to discuss, and the first one you tossed out was Justine Abshire.
Yeah, well, that's certainly been a story that I've been covering for years. Back in probably spring of 2004 is when I spring of 2007 is when I started covering that story. She, of course, is a young woman. She was 27 at the time, and it appeared to be a hit and run in November of 2006. And at first, that's how it was being investigated. And then in the spring, her parents came out expressing suspicion that her husband's story wasn't adding up. They they were having some doubts about it, and then it's sort of built, and they put out a $50,000 reward, and then the police started releasing some information that really suggested that what had appeared to be a hit and run really couldn't have been, that she didn't die from injuries sustained by a car, being struck by a car. And so then it took years of investigating on this, and this was a story that ended up being covered in the national media on an ABC primetime crime episode in the summer of 2008. And he was eventually, Eric Abshire, was arrested this past December and charged with first-degree murder after this long, years-long investigation. And he will be going to trial in October. There's a two-week trial up in Orange that I will be covering.
Now, for those who are new to the area, for those who are in listening areas, not just in the Charlottesville, Omaha County, I don't remember seeing this. Maybe it's because I read The Hook every week and I don't always read our other daily paper. I don't remember seeing this really fully covered in The Progress. So can you give us a little background about, you know, was it or was it not a hit and run? But you talk about the parents not having seen things add up. Why is that? A little background.
Well, I mean, that's when I sort of got in, because that it had been covered for the first few months by all the other media, and I really hadn't done anything on it. And then they came out with this statement in April or May of 2007 saying this, and I thought, wait a second, what is going on here? Everybody had just kind of believed that she was hit by some mystery driver. But the issues, the holes in his story, I think, were what started to really bother them. And the story that he had told was that she came home, she had come home from class, she was getting her master's degree at UVA, and she was a teacher at elementary school in Culpeper. And she wasn't feeling well, and his mother was in the hospital, and somehow they had argued this night, so they got in a fight, and she takes off in her car, and some period of time later, you know, within the hour, he says, she calls and says her car is broken down and he needs to come pick her up. So he then says he takes 10 or 15 minutes to get ready to leave. And this is a cold November night. And so his wife, even though they've just fought, she's saying she's out on this dark road alone with a car that doesn't work. So he heads out on a motorcycle, which he would later say was because his car was in storage and there were various things. And then when he gets to this road, which is about 5 miles, I think, from their house, he sees something in the road and he thinks it's an animal. And as he gets closer, he says that he sees it's his wife. And then his behavior continues to seem odd, I think, to a lot of people. He gets off his motorcycle, sits in the road holding her. He's not sure if she's dead or alive, and he sits there for 10 or 15 minutes with her before going for help. And he has a cell phone in his pocket, but he forgets it's there. And then he starts banging on doors and asks somebody to call 911. And then when they come, she's dead. So it's a bizarre description. And a lot of people, you know, said, well, you know, why wouldn't you have A, used your cell phone, or at the very least, if you forgot you had your cell phone, immediately run for help? Would you sit there?
An ongoing, unusual list of decisions.
Yeah, and then when you really start putting together the timeline, it just becomes, you know, even stranger. The length of time of this phone call where she supposedly said, "My car's broken down, come get me," was like seconds, like under 10 seconds, maybe, or just almost. You'd have to use maybe 5 words to get the message out. And he said, "Well, she was still mad, so she didn't talk." You know, she didn't talk much. She just said, she was on Taylorsville Road. So I'm on this road, pick me up. I mean, is that, I don't know. Maybe that's how it happened. But it seems odd. And then of course the number of injuries she sustained, just massive trauma, going from memory, but I think it's 120 separate blunt trauma injuries to her body, but no strike marks, which is the marks that you would expect on somebody's legs from a car bumper if they're hit while they're standing. So none of that. Her pelvis was broken in several places, but she had a huge number of injuries to her head.
And, you know, as we go on, the parents don't believe a lot of this. The parents are questioning exactly what happened, based on the story that they're told.
Based on the story, yeah. Based on the story. Based also, there's, it's such a, you know, as this stuff has sort of unfolded, there was a lot of insurance money that potentially could come out of her death. Some of it was because she was a teacher, and so she had, that wasn't a huge policy, though. I think she had maybe $150,000 or something, but it, in the case of an accidental death, it would double. So, but then the bigger deal was this thing that I think most people may not even be aware of, which is uninsured motorist insurance, which you have, most people will have on their vehicles. And for a personal vehicle like a car, it's not going to be that much, but it, it covers you in case you are hit if, in a hit and run where you don't know who the driver is, or if you're hit by somebody who has no insurance, it will cover you. And so it's typically maybe up to 100,000 or 150, but for some reason she was, listed as the owner of a dump truck, a commercial. So she was the beneficiary of this commercial policy that had $1 million. So if she was to be killed by an uninsured or unknown motorist, potentially the payout would be $1 million. So that was, you know, I think that's what started to really raise eyebrows, that there was this huge amount of money for this young woman who, as a teacher, you wouldn't think she'd have that much insurance.
Who didn't have any money.
So...
when you do this reporting, again, we are talking with Courtney Stewart from Charlottesville's The Hook. She's senior editor. We're talking about one of the articles that she's covered for 4 years or so now.
Yeah, it's coming up on that.
The Justine Abshire mysterious death and her widower, Eric Abshire, who will be going to court later this year. Courtney, when you do a story like this, are you getting information from the police, et cetera, and then writing it in your own fashion? Or are you doing research on these?
I mean, in fact, you know, as a reporter, I mean, certainly you hope that the police will share something with you, but that's never, you know, where you're going to get the real story, because if they hold a press conference, they're going to put out the information that they want you to report that's going to help their investigation, and everybody's going to have the same information. And so you really can't do an original report based on what they're going to tell you. And they have reasons that they don't want certain information to get out. They feel like, you know, it for the investigation. So in this case or in some others, really what ends up happening is, you know, you find sources, you call people that may know something, they may send you off down, you know, another path, and you start just digging around and snooping and talking to people, and that's where it comes from.
Can you tell us a few of the tidbits or major bits of information that you got by doing your reporter searching?
I think in the first story, one of the other really bizarre things was and it will be interesting to see at trial whether this actually does come up or whether police really believe this played a role. But there was an SUV that was found in a storage locker, and which was only about half a mile or a mile from the site of her death, out in Orange. Well, it's right near the Orange Green Line. So this SUV pops up when the owner of the storage business is checking unlocked, unrented units. All of a sudden, there's this stolen thing. Well, it turns out that just days before her death, Eric Abshire had looked at this vehicle at a dealership over on 29, and he had come in and looked at it, and then according to the car dealership, soon, within a day or so, the key to the car disappeared, and then the car disappeared, and then it appears, you know, it's found a couple of months after she's killed. And so I do know police went and cut fabric from that vehicle, but nobody told me that. I found that just through phone calling and
research, talking
to people. Yeah. So that was one detail.
One of the other things that I believe that I read in one of the articles that you wrote for The Hook about this topic, there's a wrongful death suit out there, I believe, from Justine's parents.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just against the widower Eric. It's against a half dozen people, including family members. Now, why would you do that?
Well, I think that they believe that Eric, if he didn't act, I don't know whether they have a specific theory about how multiple people might have played a role in her death, but I do believe that they think that these people have helped him in some way after the fact, or that they may have helped before. And so this lawsuit that they filed, they have, you know, you have certain time periods where you have to do things. And I think they tried to put off the filing of this. Usually it's a 2-year statute of limitations on civil cases, but they did some fancy legal work where you file and then you withdraw, and then it gives you an extra 6 months where you can refile. So they didn't bring this. I think they wanted to see the criminal. They want the criminal investigation to go through. The civil side, they're less interested. But if at the point that they filed it, there was no arrest, and they were at the end of the time frame. But they filed, I think it's $5 million against Eric, his brother, Jesse, and then a cousin, and Eric's the mother of his children.
All right, we are talking with Courtney Stewart from The Hook. It is 11:21. Here on the Wake Up Call. Dial us up with questions or comments about any of the topics that we go through today. Currently talking about Justine Abshire and the mysterious hit and run or not death from 2007. Courtney's covered this for many articles for The Hook. 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. Market's a Tiger Fuel forcast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly sunny today, 20% chance of showers over in the valley, and highs in the mid-80s. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the mid-60s. And then tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs back in the 90s. Right now, out in the valley, it's clear and 75, 74 in Lynchburg, 79 in Richmond, 81 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank The Backyard for their support. UVA Corner's Culinary Secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard has a seasonal menu. They have daily specials and a rotating list of beers on tap. For more info, you can call them, 202-8215. You can visit them online, thebackyarduva.com. They even have a Facebook page. And as always, let me take a moment to thank everyone for listening, especially those whose support makes what we do possible. We couldn't bring you the music you love or the Wake Up Call every Sunday without listeners like Irene Burlock, Ted Henneberry, and Shane Harrison, who donated to our most recent fund drive back in the spring. Also, some businesses like Quiznos and Goat Busters, who underwrite the programming that you rely on. If you appreciate WNRN's contributions to your life, then show your support by calling us in the next fund drive coming up in September or donating anytime online at WNRN.org. All right, back with today's guest, Courtney Stewart. Right now we're talking about the Justine Abshire story that she's written. I don't know. Have you gotten to double digits now on the number of articles you've written?
Yeah, I'm sure there's probably a couple dozen.
I see Kristen running in with something, and as I saw the phone ringing, comment, slow down the growth of the roads, don't need a new bypass. Well, you know what? I'm going to get to that in a minute, too, but we're currently talking about Justine Abshire. That's what I get for not proofreading before I just stick it on the air. So we're talking about Justine Abshire, and we talked about the wrongful death suit. So obviously the parents have their belief, which is always going to happen. But this is going to court sometime in October.
October. It's a 2-week trial, the 12th to the 26th.
As a journalist who I assume has covered many court hearings, do you believe that you're going to get an answer then?
Well, I can't wait to hear what they have, because as has been pointed out, I think in the comments, the online comments under many stories, you know, what's been in the press is at best a circumstantial case, and there has to be more information, I think, in order for them to, if they are hoping to get a conviction, which obviously they are. So I am looking forward to hearing what new information comes out, what explanations that they have for some of his behavior or and their theory of how this really happened, because they do not think she didn't have the other she didn't have blood in her body, and there was not enough blood at the scene, so she was not killed there. She was killed somewhere else. And so I'm interested to hear where they think this may have happened.
So when you say she didn't have blood in her body, you mean that she was killed somewhere and that's where the big loss of blood took place?
Right. Right. That she did not have enough blood in her body to match the amount of blood that was at the scene. You know, there's blood missing. And it's a terrible, you know, it's just horrific, you know, really.
Well, you've also, if I'm not mistaken, you've also done the majority of the writing on the
Morgan Harrington
mm-hmm. story, correct?
Yeah.
How do you write about these stories? How do you distance yourself as a person, as a parent, from writing about these stories?
Well, you know, I guess sometimes you don't. I mean, you sort of, you know, sometimes you're just looking at it kind of like a mystery, but then you get these frequent reminders that these are people with families. I mean, you know, talking to the families. And I guess I feel like if in some way through the coverage it can help bring in tips to the police, or it can help in whatever way inform the community, try maybe protect somebody else from something terrible happening, then, you know, I that's sort of what motivates me.
And again, I don't want to get too far away from Justine Abshar. We're talking about that now with Courtney Stewart, who's done the majority of the writing on that mystery story for The Hook. Is there anything new? I can't remember the last time I saw an updated article about Morgan Harrington, other than the parents and something that they're doing in terms of keeping the story in the news.
It's a hard one because obviously I would like to be, you know, I'd like to have more to report. I'd like there to be a break in the case, whether it's, I mean, something the police come out with, but there really hasn't been anything. It has just been quiet. And other than the parents are doing everything they can to make sure that she stays, you know, her face stays in the news and she's remembered. It's hard to keep writing about something when there's nothing new to report other than, you know, I mean, they came up here and held a bake sale. And a fundraiser, and you know, of course, they wanted to raise funds because they're building a school for her in her honor. There's like an educational wing in an African school, but really, the reason was to make sure that there's something for people to write about, so the case isn't forgotten.
And as a reporter, we talk about these two sort of, I guess murder mystery is. I mean, I don't want to fall too much into the fictional book sounding thing, but whether it's Morgan Harrington, whether it's Justine Abshar, they are mysterious murders. How do you, you know, have you, what research have you been able to do in Morgan Harrington?
Well, that one, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, what you want is to find people who might know something that the general public doesn't know, somebody who saw her that night. So that was what I started with when I first started covering Morgan Harrington, was trying to track down witnesses. And that is just a process of, you know, throwing a wide net. I mean, I was on Facebook scouring, you know, looking for people who made comments about, you know, being at that concert, and then, you know, calling them and, or, you know, messaging them and seeing if they knew anybody, if they'd heard anything, because of course, if you were at the concert, then it's going to be even more, disturbing and compelling. And so that's how I found not just Facebook, but just word of mouth and tracking people down, until I got to the people who actually had seen her that night. And so that I think set my reporting apart, because I did have these eyewitnesses, you know, you just getting out there and knocking on doors. And
do you know if there's going to be any, whether you have any inside information or just general conversation? The parents are trying to get some Virginia law passed that allows whatever the proper phrasing is, but the wider net of DNA.
Oh, familial DNA, and that is, I think.
Can you tell me what that is again?
Sure, that is. We have a DNA. Every state, I think, has a DNA database or data bank, but up until recently, like just within the last couple of months, you could only search for an exact match. You know, you have an unknown DNA sample, you run it through, and then you get a match back, and it may be that person. This would allow you to run it through, to run an unknown sample to see if it hasn't matched exactly, to see if there's a close relative, which would then allow you to narrow the search. I mean, if you by close relative, I think they want a sibling or a parent or a child. So we're talking sort of one degree of separation. And if you know that you've got a match and then it has to be somebody in this person's immediate family, then you're looking at a very tiny group of people as opposed to everybody in the state of Virginia. And so the Harringtons pushed for that, and it has gone through. And I think that makes Virginia the third state that has this capability. That we've got you need software, and there's an added expense, of course, to doing this. And it won't be appropriate for every case, but there are a number of really hideous crimes where this maybe could be a tool. It's how they got the Grim Sleeper in California in 2010, I think.
And I mean, is it now just a how easy or difficult is it to actually run the DNA, or when can we expect that all the DNA on file can?
Well, it's still very unlikely that you're going to get somebody, because in order to have your DNA in the databank in the first place, you have to be a felon. And so it's not like everybody's got their DNA in this state databank. So, they wouldn't announce. I mean, if they get a match, they're not going to come out and say, guess what, we got a match. They're going to wait until they've done the further investigating that they would have to do based on that match. And, you know, I would think that we wouldn't hear until there was an arrest and they would say, hey, actually, it worked. I mean, they're not going to tell us what they're doing.
11:31 on the wake-up call with Courtney Stewart, senior editor at The Hook. Let me thank Wolf Trap for their support here on WNRN. Wolf Trap National Park for the Performing Arts is presenting Emmylou Harris and her Red Dirt Boys, Saturday, July 23rd. That's just this upcoming Saturday. Tickets are on sale at wolftrap.org. You can call them 877-WOLF-TRAP. That's Emmylou Harris and her Red Dirt Boys at Wolf Trap, where the arts come out to play. We are talking with Courtney Stewart about several of the articles that she has written for The Hook. Courtney, you did something recently, I guess maybe just back in May, on Lyme disease.
Yes.
Which caught my attention because I have a dog, mm-hmm. and we use Frontline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't guess I'm going to get any grief about being specific. And this summer, I have picked multiple ticks off of him. Frontline is working as it should. Why isn't there anything for me? I mean, we'll get into Lyme disease and what it, you know, and the causes, the people, and why it's as important enough to be a cover story for The Hook.
You mean, why isn't there Frontline for humans?
Yes. Why can't
that's a good question.
You know, why isn't there something? Because, as we'll get into, as you have written, it's an incredibly dangerous disease that is growing rapidly. I think, I don't know if I copied this from you or from somewhere in one of the comments, it's increased 8 times its original, you know, percentage of problems just in the last 2 years. Did you find any in your research that there's something that people can do to help prevent themselves, as they do their dogs and cats, from Lyme disease?
Well, you know, I wouldn't know the exact science behind why we can't put Frontline on ourselves, but there are bug repellents that you can use. And there's also, you know, just basic safety stuff, like when you go for a hike, you stay in the center of the trail. When you come out, you know, you or your kids, you do a tick check. And if you find a tick, you get it off, as you know, hopefully before it attaches. I did not realize until I did this article just how scary Lyme disease is, and the fact that it's the cases are skyrocketing, and just how difficult it can be to treat if it gets beyond a certain point.
Tell me about the skyrocketing cases.
Well, I think there's disagreement. I mean, the CDC...
Center for Disease Control.
Yeah, and the Department of Health, maybe, the Virginia Department of Health, have put out reports saying that, you know, it's here, that there's this huge increase in the number of cases. But they also say that it may be underreported, even if the increase may be larger, that the reported cases may reflect just some small percentage of how many people actually contract Lyme. And so I guess for those who don't know, it's a tick-borne illness. It typically presents, or it's best known for a bullseye rash around the site of a tick bite. So you get a tick, you pull it off, and if there's a round rash with sort of a clear center around the bite, that's a sure sign of Lyme. However, not everybody gets that rash, and it can progress beyond that, excuse me, to causing swelling in joints, fatigue, and then if it goes further, it can actually cross into your brain, and then you end up with this hideous array of symptoms that can include cognitive problems, neurological symptoms, and that is where there's a lot of debate over the best way to treat it.
We are currently talking about Lyme disease with Courtney Stewart. It's one of the articles that she wrote, I believe, in May of 2011. Mm-hmm. It's a cover story for The Hook. She is an editor, senior editor at The Hook. You're welcome to call with your question or comment about any of these stories that we're covering, but let's keep to the stories that we're talking about. We will get into some of the other comments later in the hour or on another program. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. You can also send a question or comment to WNRN Studio as an instant message on AOL, which is what I have now. And the question is, can you go over the difference in ticks? Not everyone gets it from Lyme disease, or not everyone gets Lyme disease from them.
Well, the Lyme is carried by the blackleg tick, which is also known as a deer tick. It's much smaller. It's not the dog tick, which is a bigger one. And part of the problem with these ticks is that they're so tiny, particularly in the nymph stage, that you may not even ever see that you've been bitten by a tick. And particularly if it's in your hair, you wouldn't see the rash. Does that answer the?
I think so. But so, and again, as someone who read the article but didn't do any of the research about it, the difference in the ticks, if my dog comes home with the tick, and whether he's, wherever you allow your dog to go, on the bed, on the sofa, on the floor, and I happen to get it from there, if I have a tick that I know came from the dog, does that mean that I don't have the dangerous tick?
No. I mean, blackleg ticks bite dogs also.
Okay.
It's a particular type of tick. So if you get bitten by a tick, it's not a guarantee that you're going to get Lyme. It's widely believed it has to be attached for, 36 hours, more than 24 hours, and 36 to 48, I think, in order to transmit. Although some people are saying it could be much faster than that. It's not, you don't need to panic about it if you see a tick on yourself. You just need to get it off, and you need to be aware that if you get redness or a rash around the site, or if you start having joint pain or fatigue, that you need to get treated for it, and not even really tested for it, because the test is very inaccurate. If you have the rash, the treatment is a round of antibiotics, and that should clear it if you get it early. It's when you miss it and you've had it for a year or more that you can get into these more serious problems.
One of the things I remember reading in the article is, and I think the phrase you used was Lyme wars, because there's, two sides of the issue from doctors.
Right. And sort of the mainstream, which would include physicians, probably most of the physicians at UVA, is that you have a case of Lyme, you treat it with an antibiotic, and the Lyme is gone, and that any symptoms that persist past the treatment are not related to an active infection by these spirochetes, which are the bacteria that cause the disease. That there's no active infection, that it is now maybe an immune response that is leading to these things, and that antibiotics, there's not going to be any further effectiveness from taking longer, taking it longer or higher doses. And then there's the other camp, which call themselves Lyme-literate doctors, who say that you may need a year of intravenous antibiotics to get these spirochetes if they have gotten into your brain, or that there's a way for these things to survive in your body and be inaccessible by the antibiotics so that they can continue to do damage and that the infection really is active. And there's a documentary out, I think called Under Our Skin, which is distressing to watch, to say the least, because, you know, these people have what appears to be, you know, one guy was diagnosed with ALS, which is a always fatal neurodegenerative disease. And in this film, you know, he says, well, no, it turns out I had Lyme. And with the treatment, he actually recovered. So there's the, but it's pretty heated, because the, you know, the sort of mainstream doctors are calling the Lyme literate doctors charlatans and saying that they're preying on people who are suffering, but their treatments really offer them nothing and could be harmful. And then you have the Lyme literate doctors saying, you know, you people are ignoring an epidemic.
11:40 on the Wake Up Call. We are talking with Courtney Stewart about Lyme disease, a cover story that she wrote in May of this year. Courtney, I want to get right back to this after this next break about you spoke with a couple local individuals about their Lyme disease, and I want to jump into that. Let me do this first. Dixon Disposal is a supporter of WNRN. They remind you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep the planet green for years to come as well. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. 978-2111 or DixonDisposal.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
And 75 years ago, the residents of Nicholson Hollow in Madison County were portrayed as hillbillies. Their farms, the school, church, mill, and road, all for hillbillies. Then, 75 years ago, the Hollow became part of the East Coast First National Park when it opened after heaps of controversy. There's an online financial magazine that's been around since 1976, naming Charlottesville one of the 10 cities that embody the American dream. And the Belmont Bridge fence could pose a bike hazard. That's all in this week's copy of The Hook, Healthy and Beautiful, and with dependable plumbing. And let me thank L. Oppelman's as well. Central Virginia's complete music headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department is now featuring acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, and violins, as well as electric guitar packages. Also available, complete drum sets. You can find L. Oppelman at 909 Main Street in Lynchburg. Online, it's L. Oppelman.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because at noon it's Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative music with Drew Thompson. That's Arrested Development, The Bangles, and Devo, all brought to you in part by Caliente. Drew likes requests on Les Temps Perdue. All right, back with our guest today, Courtney Stewart. Courtney, you didn't just write about Lyme disease. You interviewed, my memory says two, although that may not be correct, about going through the process of having Lyme disease, believing that they had Lyme disease, visiting the couple types of doctors on the two sides of the story. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, one of the people that I spoke with is Emily Tinsley, who's married to Dave Matthews Band violinist Boyd. And she is a nurse. She described just becoming debilitated by an illness, and she didn't know what it was. I guess she's from up north where Lyme has been, so maybe she started to suspect it was Lyme. But she just got worse and worse, and to the point she said that she was really completely disabled, incapacitated, couldn't hold a conversation, was bedridden. She's a mother, you know, was unable to really perform any of the duties that she needs to perform. And she ended up going, after seeing, you know, doctors around here, she ended up going up north, as a number of people around here have done to find one of these Lyme literate doctors who then diagnosed her with several other tick-borne illnesses. So the problem for her was that she didn't just have Lyme. She had several other infections. And that apparently is a common problem. And if you don't treat all of them, you can end up not having a good result from the treatment. So she has improved tremendously taking long-term antibiotics, she says. So that was one of the stories that I told in that article.
Is it, in doing your research, did you find that the more further north, because I guess Lyme disease was started in the northeast region.
Well, it was first Connecticut is where it was first identified, and that was in a group of kids who were all complaining of they all had swollen joints, and so it was recognized there as a problem, and then it spread out. It's spread out from there.
Did you find that in doing your research though that the more the greater percentage of the, whether it was a doctor, whether it was a citizen, if they had some sort of attachment to Connecticut, Massachusetts, that area where it was first recognized, that they were easier or to believe that that's what they had?
Well, I think that people who have been aware of it for longer may be faster to recognize that it's a possibility. Are you asking?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think that if you're aware of it, I mean, that's what you hope with, I'm not the only journalist that's done articles on Lyme recently, and it's because people in Virginia now need to be as aware as people in the Northeast who have had years to kind of get used to the idea and to recognize that ticks can be dangerous. And around here, we haven't necessarily been thinking about it for that long, although a lot of people will say it's been here for a lot longer than the health department would have us believe.
But is this something that is Lyme disease spreading? Like, do you start in, we'll say, Connecticut, and you can, you know, if you have that color-coded map where you can see it growing from that corner, or is it just an intellectual an awareness that's growing? Is the disease spreading, or the awareness of the disease with spreading?
Well, I think that the disease itself is spreading, but I think also awareness. I mean, I don't know really how to answer that. I know that one of the other people I talked to for the article said that his dog had Lyme disease here in Virginia at a farm in Albemarle County 14 or 15 years ago, and that he got it at the same time. So for them to say that it's just now arriving in Virginia, his dog tested positive and his dog had not been, you know, traveling around the country. His dog contracted it here. And, you know, so it's been here for years. I do think maybe it's spreading. I don't know why it would suddenly be sort of exploding and so many ticks would be carrying it. But there needs to be better surveying done also.
11:47 on the Wake Up Call with Courtney Stewart. Courtney, whether you do an article on Justine Abshire, which I believe you said, that story ended up in the national media as one of the mystery cases.
Right.
Or on Lyme disease. Back to the Justine Abshire, did that national television show copy anything that you had said? Did they garner some of the news?
I worked
that they
with
put
them.
Out?
They contacted me. They that was a nice experience. Actually, I ended up being on that program, and I think that's how it works a lot with the national media. Is, you know, you have sort of local journalists who are reporting first on stories and getting some of the nitty gritty details, and that then gets kind of lobbed up to the national media, who come in with much greater resources, and so they were able to get stuff that I hadn't gotten. But they were nice to work with, and actually Dateline will be doing a program, I think, on the same case after the trial. So,
Do you find that, you know, have you had any other experience with that, with the articles you've written, whether it was Morgan Harrington, whether it was Lyme disease that we've talked about, you've been working for The Hook
for as long as it's been around.
Yeah, we don't need to go into official right. dates with a woman. But you've been working for The Hook for a long time now, and you've written a great number of articles.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had previous experience with that with your other articles?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I think I and also my colleagues have all experienced having a story that you've worked on, that you've put a lot of effort into, get picked up and reported nationally. And, you know, it's always nice if you're credited, you know, if they say as, you know, first reported or whatever. But it's also sort of, it's nice to see stories that deserve attention or that need sort of recognition getting picked up and being told to a wider audience. And that's, I see that as sort of, you know, the one of the roles of a local journalist is to kind of bring the stories from your tiny little area to light, because it's kind of like you're the microscope and then they're the magnifying glass or something.
Well, there's also the, I guess an article that, I don't know if it, if you can say that applies the same time with national and local hitting it at the same time, or maybe sort of even inverted with Oliver Kuttner and
sure.
The X car.
Yeah, the X Prize, his very light car.
Right. Give me a little background on that.
Sure. Well, Oliver Kuttner, he's a sort of man who wears many hats. He's best known around here probably for being a developer and owning properties. He developed the terraces on the downtown mall, which is that huge building, I think, on the corner of Water and Second.
Right.
Anyway,
above,
he's
above
also
the, above the theater, right? Isn't that behind the?
It's,
regardless, I stopped your thought. Keep going.
Yeah, no, it's on the corner. It's not Live Arts. It's like next
no,
to
no,
Jefferson.
No, 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 no. I'm thinking yeah. behind the movie theater, behind the Regal. Unimportant
yeah,
to your
okay.
part. Unimportant to your part of the story. Sorry.
So that's okay. So he ended up moving down to Lynchburg, or no, he didn't move, but he ended up moving a lot of his investing down to Lynchburg. He's also a race car driver and developer, and so he sort of kind of put these things together and then put a team together, and they ended up winning the $5 million in the Progressive Automotive X Prize for building this vehicle that could get 100 miles. Per gallon and meet safety requirements and be able to go a certain range. And they did this by reducing the weight rather than going as many of the other teams competing went with electric and, you know, electric engines. And they chose to stick with gasoline and just use much less of it by making the car so light.
And when you did that story, you've covered this article
mm-hmm.
for The Hook. Again, Courtney Stewart from The Hook with us today. That was covered at the same time by the national media?
Yeah, I mean, that was something where I think my article may have sort of come out a little bit ahead of time, but certainly it was going to become, I mean, he won the, you know, he won this huge international competition, so you didn't need a local journalist to report that first, but it was nice to be able to be on a story like that early and sort of, and I thought, you know, I thought he had a good chance of winning even early on just because what he was saying made sense. But of course, there were a lot of strong teams competing. So it was fun to report sort of early in the process and then watch it go all the way through to his victory.
But you always vote for the local guy when
of
you can.
Of course, of course.
And I would think, like with many of the other stories, you continue to cover it because he won the competition, but the process doesn't end there.
Right. And that's another where, you know, that's another place where a local journalist, you know, you're going to stick with something, maybe your attention span may be a little longer for something like that. So I do want to know, and I did a little update a couple of weeks ago, just wanted to see, you know, where, what's happening. Are you, the national media might wait for him to get the big deal with some car manufacturer that's going to bring it to the streets when everybody can buy it. But I want to know sort of along the way, what's happening. They're speaking, he and his Edison 2 team are going and speaking at conventions, car conventions, and talking to big manufacturers around the world. And sounds like some good things are happening. But of course, their goal is to see these things being driven. And so they're making a variety of new, they have one that's now got an electric drivetrain, and they're sort of polishing the exterior to make it maybe more acceptable to the general public as something they might actually buy and drive.
And do you know from, I would think, having that sort of inside scoop as someone who's followed the article for before others did, is there any sort of knowledge about, you know, when this might all happen? Are we talking about 5 years, 20 years?
You know, I don't think they know the answer to that. I think they hope it would be less than 5 years. I mean, they want to see this happen. And we, you know, certainly the energy problems and price of gas and all of this, we need to get serious about some of these issues. So I think they're hoping that, this car will be one piece that helps the general public become less dependent and helps this country kind of become less dependent on foreign oil. But I don't know. Will it be a couple of years? I think it depends on whether a big fish, like a big company, bites and says we're gonna bring this to the market.
Real quick, do you know why he took his team to Lynchburg rather than Albemarle? He was doing all his work. He was doing a majority of his work here in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area. As you said, property owner, doing a lot of development. And then you take your currently what I would think to be your largest project and the thing that's first on your to-do list, and you take it elsewhere.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that he's told me over the years. One is that he went down to Lynchburg, and he convinced a bunch of people from here to go down there, too, because you could really get property there for a fraction of what you'd pay here. I mean, the real estate prices here were and even still are high compared to down in Lynchburg. So he was buying up a lot of downtown property and fixing it up and trying to reinvigorate their downtown. As far as locating his company, the car company, Edison 2, Lynchburg is a place that still has a lot of manufacturing, small manufacturers who could make the pieces that he needed for this car. So he had these things, you know, these manufacturers right blocks away from where this was happening. So he could go and say, I need a, you know, whatever, a nut or a bolt this size, and can you do this? And somebody could whip it out and drive it over. And that was what appealed, I think, in another way about Lynchburg, is that it still is a manufacturing town.
Courtney Stewart here from The Hook as we get close to finishing our hour on sort of updated articles, current events on things that Courtney has written about. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. We were just talking about Oliver Kuttner being down in Lynchburg. Is he still working on? Is there like phase two? You talked about sort of remodeling the current car
so that
it can go through. But is there, you know, is there a completely different car, completely different style that they're doing? Or are they just trying to make the one really popular?
They have to. I think they have to use sort of the idea behind the prototype, which is that it's sort of a bullet shape and it has these wheels that wheels are set apart from the main body, and that provides sort of impact protection inside collisions. But they're just smoothing it out some. I don't know, you know, the latest version we ran a picture of, it's still very futuristic. It still does not look like anything that's currently being driven on the road. And I don't know that it needs to, but I think, you know, I mean, the typical American driver, I mean, some people would probably just love having something that looked like this, and some people who really like traditional cars may just think no way. So they've got to try to appeal to enough people that it'll be a commercial success.
All right. Our last couple minutes with Courtney. Courtney, I think for a lot of people who follow the news on a regular basis, one of the more interesting things from 2011, I have no idea how much you have done any research on it or follow it in the least. You must follow it a little, is that The Hook has purchased the major competitor, what many people consider the major competitor.
Well, I don't know if that's what's happened, I guess, is that there's a new parent company that has both papers now, that's operating both papers.
So many people look for The Hook and the Seville Weekly. They're two different newspapers, they're different topics, et cetera, and they even come out on different days, and suddenly one purchases the other.
Well, but
has
I don't
that
think, no,
your
one,
work list in any way?
One, I mean, I think they kind of, there was sort of a merger. I mean, it has not affected anything about my experience in the newsroom. I mean, we have separate offices. There's no communication going on between the two papers as far as coverage.
You don't get a call that says, by the way, don't cover that or don't write a story on that because they're doing that instead?
No, and, we all had questions when this happened. It was fairly shocking to those of us who were around for the beginning of The Hook, which
of
course
breakup.
You know, came out of a breakup of the partners at Seville, so it was shocking, and initially I kind of wondered, well, what does this mean? Is it, but as far as I can tell at this point, it means nothing for the reporters at both papers.
All right, last question. to finish up here with Courtney Stewart, senior editor from The Hook. Can we look for that you're working on now? You don't have to give us the inside stuff on a story that's going to break. But, you know, do you have anything that you can share with us that's going to be coming up in the next couple weeks?
Sure. Let me think. I'm working on a lot of stories. I'm going to be doing I don't want to be too specific about things, but I've got several things relating to school. I've got some issues with
when you say school, like the school systems?
The school systems, yeah. They'll probably time those stories around the back to school period.
Because we will have both superintendents, Charlottesville and Albemarle County, on together here in mid-August.
Oh, interesting.
So if you have a question you'd like me to ask for your news story, please email it along.
Well, I'm going to be looking at, you know, the types of foods they're serving in the schools and efforts to make them healthier. That's sort of a topic that is close to my heart as a...
And I think I'm doing a show on that on August 1st with the sugar in the schools.
Oh, good.
Group.
With who are you having on?
I can't remember Ivana's last
name. Ivana Khadija.
Ivana Khadija,
yeah.
Yes.
She's very vocal in her feelings about this stuff and involved. So yeah, doing that, doing some more crime stories, doing
those are my favorite.
I mean those are the ones that are, you know,
unfortunately
really
they're
compelling
true.
To,
I like the fictional ones better.
I know. Yeah, then you don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be so sad.
All right. Courtney, thanks so much for
Thank
being
you,
here
Rick.
With me today.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate that very much. Next week, stay tuned. It'll be another surprise. Drew Thompson's up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.